culture doesn't always do justice to what the activity itself has to offer, and that's very frustrating. But it's not everything that surfing is. And what, yeah, like the best of surfing is the best of like all the sports, which is being in your body and feeling good about that, whatever that is. You don't have to be good at it to feel that. And then the chance to be on a wave and to ride this like energy that's come across the ocean, more cliches, surfers, you know, talk this way all the time, to connect with other people who enjoy the same sport as you, to feel a sense of community, like all that stuff's there. But the worst of it gets the most press, I think.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Transnational Perspectives Podcast. This is the show where we put nature in focus while sharing perspectives on society and culture across environments and landscapes. I'm your host, Josh Bennett, recording live here in Oslo, Norway, bringing you conversations with researchers, artists, activists, and all kinds of other people from all around the world who are here to share their experiences and their efforts, give us some inspiration and some tools that we need so that you and me and we and everyone else can start working together towards a socially and ecologically sustainable future today. As we like to say, we must attack the issues of social and ecological injustice at large from wherever we may sit or stand. The Transnational Perspectives Podcast is brought to us by listeners like you. If you find value in this show and you want to help it grow, please consider sharing this podcast, writing a review, and supporting the show. Head on over to transnaturalperspectives.com to learn more about how you can contribute as a monthly subscriber, as a one-time donor, as well as check out our blog. I invite you to contact me with any ideas you have for the show. If you'd like to be a guest, if you need a writer, or any other tips on further funding opportunities, I'd really love to hear from you. It keeps this show going, keeps me going. And with that being said, today I'm really excited to be speaking with Dr. Rebecca Olive. Dr. Olive is a senior research fellow in the School of Human Movement and Nutrition Sciences at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia. Her feminist cultural studies research is focused on women's experiences through surfing and issues of localism in the water and on social media. Her work focuses on issues of equity and diversity in action lifestyle sports and cultures in particular. Dr. Olive's research engages with questions of power, ethics, pedagogy, and everyday life, including online, and it is driven by a commitment to community engagement. Dr. Olive is committed to connecting teaching and research and has developed a presence in cultural media and communities relevant to her research in coastal cultures, recreational lifestyle sports, social media, and ethnographic methods. Dr. Olive is a regular contributor to surf media, festivals, and writes her blog. I'm particularly excited to have Dr. Olive on the show today because I'm a huge fan of her writing. And I think after this talk and our discussion, you might be a huge fan too. With that being said, this is a bit of a long episode, so I'm not going to keep you here too long. Please enjoy the show and stick around afterwards for a little bit of reflection. Dr. Rebecca Olive on the podcast today, and I'm really excited to have you on the show because we've actually been emailing back and forth for a long time about different articles and all kinds of stuff that I've been reading of yours. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I enjoy listening to this show, so it's a lovely thing to be able to be part of it.
So I've been following your work for a little while now, and I have to say, you know, aside from just the topics that you discuss, which are kind of hit close to home in me and spark my interest, I just really enjoy the way that you write. It's, you know, in a lot of academic literature, you know, can be at different levels of readability. And of course, it's very subjective to the reader. But for me personally, I find it, you know, very interesting, very great research, interesting topics. And at the same time, very like literary, like interesting and nice to read.
Aww.
So for me, that's like a big plus. And so if anybody's out there listening, I know I'm doing a plug. I should do that at the end of the show. I'm doing a plug now. look into some of this literature because it's very just nice to read.
Oh, that's the best compliment I could get. Thank you so much.
So anyways, now people say, okay, but what are we reading? What are we talking about here? I've tried to summarize it myself. Could you maybe just summarize a little bit of what you're researching and what you're studying here?
Okay, so I research recreational nature-based sports. So the sports that I focus on are surfing and ocean swimming. And I focus on all the politics that happen with those activities. So a lot of the time with sports like surfing and ocean swimming, and other examples of nature-based lifestyle sports would be mountain biking and skateboarding could be one, skiing and snowboarding are other examples as well, mountain climbing. We often romanticize these activities as being separate from any political kind of behaviors, but actually they're really political sort of activities. So I started surfing and realized there was some politics happening out in the water. There weren't as many women in the water. Often those women seem to get a lot fewer waves than the men. And I started wondering why. So like any sport, sports that are sort of these non-traditional individual sports that happen in outdoor spaces have heaps of politics happening in them. And so my focus has been on sex gender politics, so the treatment of women in these spaces, but there's all kinds of politics that happen around sexuality and ableism, definitely race and ethnicity, around colonization. There's all kinds of politics. Yeah, politics amongst and between men who are often the dominant group of people in any space as well. So I'm really interested in those politics because what I'd like to see is that these sports these activities are more welcoming to more people because they are wonderful activities that are full of all kinds of benefits to us. So I've been really interested in those politics and how we can change those politics, those cultural politics. So yeah, I started by studying women surfing and looked at that for like the last 10 years or so. And so I was looking at recreational women surfing, not professional women surfing, because the professional versions of sports are so different to the recreational version. And for a long time, to understand women surfing, we looked at surf representations in surf magazines, so representation of women in surf magazines. And surf magazines are notoriously sexist. It's like, that's not a controversial statement. They really are. And so that just isn't the lived experience of what it's like to be a mediocre surfer who surfs out at the beach for fun, which is most people's experience, right? I mean, no one wants me to say that, but it's the truth. So yeah, I wanted to talk to women and understand their experiences. And also I surf, so I used my own experiences as well. And talk to men too, to understand how they were seeing things in order to understand a more nuanced version of those politics. And more recently, my work's shifted a bit more into looking at the relationships between people and coastal and ocean ecologies and the role of sport in connecting people to those ecologies or making people feel a deeper sense of connection and having more knowledge and having more ethical relationships. And in amongst that, I also look at the role of social media in all that too. So, you know, if you're going to look at surfing culture, then social media is just a huge part of that, the way it is with other cultures as well. So I'm really interested in how people are representing surfing on social media in terms of women, how women are able to represent themselves. And I'm also interested in how people interact on social media when it comes to those kind of politics. I think that's about it.
A lot of your work, you know, it goes from the very personal lived experiences of individuals, not just what we see in the magazines or what we see in the media, but then kind of takes us up through that into, okay, how is this consolidated or commodified or, you know, processed in a way that it then becomes something, you know, saucy to put out there in a magazine or on in the media, which is, yeah, typically quite different than what. So I think it's tremendous the work you're doing of like getting these, you know, lesser talked about, lesser exemplified images and ideas and stories out into the wider audience. This is something I really appreciate. And I wish I was there around when you were doing these studies about what women, but then also sometimes men are thinking about politics of surfing, because I would definitely have some things to say about that.
Well, there's really great work on it now. Like when I started, there wasn't a lot published that was not about magazines, but mm-hmm. like now there's really great work. So like Clifton Evers did amazing work on masculinity and surfing, and Georgina Roy did her PhD around the same time as me, and she was studying queer women and surfing. And they're just like a couple of examples, but there's some really great work that's pulling apart those politics now, because surfing's used to be this like marginal sport, but now in a lot of countries it's super mainstream.
One thing we haven't mentioned, I think, quite yet is, you know, why surfing and why swimming in the water. And it's because of, that's your place, right? Like that's where you're from.
So I'm from a town called Byron Bay, which is on the east coast of Australia. And it's sort of a regional town. It's become quite famous in recent times, but it's very beautiful. It's like if you drew an idyllic beach picture, this town would be that picture. And so that's the place where I grew up. And surfing is a very big part of the cultural identity of that town. It's quite a famous surf destination in surfing culture. And there's also, as long as I can remember, there's been ocean swimming across the bay every morning. And, you know, so being in the ocean's a really big part of the town. There's a surf club in the middle of the main beach. And so, you know, surf lifesaving club, that's what I mean when I say that. So there's lots of other sort of surf lifesaving activities that happen in the water. There's dive boats going out. The ocean's a really big part of life there and ocean recreation, but also it's a marine park. So there's, I don't know how long it's been a marine park. I have to find that out. So it's really really well protected. And there's lots of animals. So the humpback whales go past twice a year as they migrate south and north, and they often come into the bay. There's a big population of dolphins that lives in there, bottlenose dolphins. So, you know, it's really common to be around bottlenose dolphins. There's rays and sharks and fish and turtles and birds and all kinds of creatures that live there too. So it's very clear, clean water, or very clear water. And it's subtropical. It's very warm year round. So the coldest it will get is like the water will get is 17 degrees, you know. So it's really warm. And yeah, I mean, I grew up in that context. I didn't come to surfing till really late. And part of the reason I didn't surf till really late, despite all sorts of opportunities to do so, was my perception of surfing as something that girls didn't do. And I did have girlfriends who surfed very successfully, actually, but I still didn't see it as anything that was available to me. So I didn't start surfing until my mid-20s and instantly, like, loved it. It was like, it was that story that lots of people who surf have, is this story of like an instant connection with the sport. It's like really common. And I had that too. Like I can remember the first couple of surfs of, you know, and just was fascinated by it. And so, yeah, I've got research that's really grounded in my community still.
And you still live there to this day?
No. I live up in Brisbane now. I work at the University of Queensland. So Brisbane's about nearly 2 hours drive away. So I live just north of the Gold Coast. So I'm still quite close to the beach, and I get down when I can. And because I'm a field worker, I go to the beach for my work. So I've got lots of excuses to go down.
That sounds fantastic. This experience is very interesting to me, because in some ways I can identify on that, because I grew up in Florida, and as we were talking about before the show, kind of like similar environment and stuff like that. And as I, you know, was a person that also really enjoyed like the outdoors and all this kind of stuff, being outside, you know, playing, going to the beach, snorkeling around, all this kind of stuff. You know, one reason why your work kind of resonates with me is because I was also one of those people that was felt pushed out of the surfing environment, you know, because just wasn't that great at it probably, or, you know, I'm not supposed to get too personal on the podcast, but I'll just say, you know, maybe I wasn't in the best shape back then as a little kid or something like this. And it was really just a really unfriendly environment for the most part. And it was a lot of how I would describe, you know, at least personally, as this kind of like really like masculine environment where if you didn't, you know, get out of the way or like get off my wave and all this kind of stuff. And I don't want to paint like a bad picture of surfing, because to me it's something that's very enjoyable activity. Like most activities are enjoyable. Most outdoor experiences can be enjoyable. But yeah, once you go, not to make a bad pun, but once you go below the surface, yeah, you will find out there's a lot more going on. There's a lot to explore there. It's not just reefs and fishies.
No, it's, yeah. And it's so true that about surfing, like the worst of surfing is just the worst. It's just the worst. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I write a lot about localism too, and belonging somewhere and feeling like a sense of like being local to a place and like you fit in, that's like really nice. But the worst of it is when it becomes exclusive and it's a way of keeping people out and like you don't belong here. And surfing can mm-hmm. be really bad like that. And part of it is a perception of what surfing is. And like, I didn't surf because I thought I wasn't welcome, because I thought everyone was so good at it. And that was the only way to do was to be really good at it. And actually, when you get out in the water, what you realize is most people are okay at it. Like some people are really good at it. And surfers, it's almost like there's a rule. Like you're not supposed to say you're only mediocre at it or bad at it. Like everyone's supposed to say they're good at it. And as happens in lots of sports, the people who get the most representation and the people who get to speak for the sport the most are the people who are the best at it, who are the professionals or the, you know, or in local situations or, yeah, the most aggressive, you know. And that's like super problematic, and it keeps people out. And then the flip side is that it's this activity. It seems so counterintuitive that this aggression is part of it, because the nicest bit for me about surfing is when you're on a wave and you're just responding to it and it's taking you places you couldn't have imagined. And I'm a longboarder, right? I don't surf a shortboard. I surf like boards over 9 foot long. So they're really big and sort of maybe cumbersome, I don't know. But I find them
– cruising.
Yeah, but I find them interesting because to figure out how to turn such a big board takes knowledge of the wave. It takes – knowledge of the conditions, it takes a certain level of strength, but it also takes like a skill and experience and technique in order to maneuver it, and that takes time. But yeah, the nicest, yeah, for me, the culture doesn't always do justice to what the activity itself has to offer, and that's very frustrating. But it's not everything that surfing is. And what, yeah, like the best of surfing is the best of like all the sports, which is being in your body and feeling good about that, whatever that is. You don't have to be good at it to feel that. And then the chance to be on a wave and to ride this like energy that's come across the ocean, more cliches, surfers, you know, talk this way all the time, to connect with other people who enjoy the same sport as you, to feel a sense of community, like all that stuff's there. But the worst of it gets the most press, I think, or it gets equal press with the best of it maybe. And it's not the majority of it. It's just that if one person paddles out to a lineup and they're awful, they just make it so awful in lots of ways. So, yeah, it's a really tricky activity. And because of my research, I feel so – I'm always looking at the culture, and it's taken a lot of the pleasure away from surfing for me. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's such a bummer. But when I want to enjoy it, I just find the best of it, which is being in the water, looking at the light, looking at the colors of the water, feeling the wave, feeling the temperature, and smiling at strangers in the lineup, you know, and having these shared experiences and, yeah, focusing on all that stuff. So it's don't study the thing you love is my advice. Want to keep loving it wholly.
Or maybe I don't know. I think for some people, I know for me, I feel like I have to go deeper, because maybe that enjoyment is, you know, you got this. I know for me, for how I got into, you know, going deeper into like the outdoors and in the social issues that surrounded, were just I would sit there at the top of a mountain or at a wave or whatever, and just be like, I feel good about this, or I don't feel good about this, what's happening right now, but why? You know, why do we feel that feeling when we have these experiences in nature? You know, why do we have that feeling? You know, why are some things feel more restricted than others? Why are some spaces for some people and they don't seem like they're for other people and stuff like that? Or why is no space for the nature and it's just for the people, you know, all this kind of stuff. So I think it probably can go both ways. It can maybe demystify some things of the mystery of the natural area and the space and the experience, but it can also fill some holes for those that are curious about these.
And it's true. It helps you. I mean, you know, it's this constant question we have where how do you love problematic things or how can you still enjoy problematic things? And for me, kind of surfing maybe is an example of that where it is problematic or the culture of it's really problematic and it's, you know, problematic around sex and gender, but it's problematic around its role in ongoing forms of colonization and, you know, all these kinds of things. And so the question is like, or the task by knowing it better helps me have a more ethical relationship to it. You know, we're all contradictory. We're all engaged with things that aren't the best. So understanding them better. And it comes back for me in a way to what you talked before about my work, how it starts with myself and goes out. And that's very observant because that is exactly what I do. And it's, I use Elspeth Probyn's work and she talks about how we can think the social through ourselves. And that's a technique I use to use my own experiences in order to understand how things feel like in your guts, you know, and in your skin, because that's a really valuable way of building compassion for a situation too. But always knowing that it's not really about you. You're just using that as a tool and a starting point. So although you use yourself as a kind of pivot point to look around, you've got to, you know, look around at what's happening and understand it from the situation, you then have to expand out. Like it can't be a self-indulgent way of thinking about it. So you always have to talk to other people and go to different vantage points and look behind you as well and imagine the other factors that are influencing what's happening. So you use like your example before of sitting there and going, why do I feel so great right now? Or why do I feel so uncomfortable right now? And understanding all the factors that do that. It's such a great, well, for me, I found it such a productive approach to research to think, yeah, why do I feel so proud of doing well on that wave? Like, why do I care? The same as why would I feel ashamed if I fell off? Like, why would I care about that? So understanding those moments.
So would you say you use a lot of autoethnographic techniques mixed with like ethnographic techniques?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't use autoethnography. I mean, my work isn't centered on me. So it just uses me as a starting point and then it has to go out. And so, but it also, the thinking the social through the self is a recognition that I can't escape myself. And so it also helps me remember the limitations of what I can see or know and that this is all my work is always subjective. So in that sense, it's not autoethnographic in that I'm not exploring a sensation or a part of myself entirely through my biography or my lived experience, because my lived experience is always secondary in terms of its importance to any interviews that I do. So the interviews and other people's perspectives are always more important, but it always starts with me, which sounds again like maybe that doesn't make any sense, but yeah, like when I started using ethnographic methods for my work, I always assumed that the field work would be the key thing. And it's key in that it helps me know what questions to ask, but actually the key thing's always the interviews with other people. But I can't really engage deeply in those interviews with other people unless I've got a shared experience. Like that's the method that I use. Of course, you can interview people really well without going surfing with them. That's absolutely possible. But what I was trying to achieve was something like much more shared and based on shared experience and shared knowledge of a place and community. And so, yeah, it had to be the two in relation to each other.
All right. Yeah. Interesting. No, I didn't mean to put you in the hot seat. I know autoethnography is a hot topic in the research world. You know.
Yeah. I mean, autoethnography is, I was really unconvinced by it for a long time. And then I read a book called Seascapes by Mike Brown and Barbara Humberstone. It's an edited book.
And big fan.
It's all on autoethnography. And they asked me to read and review it for them. And I did. And by the end, I was like, okay, this is really good. Like this really helped me learn some new things. And so all the authors in that book really convinced me of the real value of autoethnography. Yeah.
Everybody's welcome here. Autoethnographers, ethnographers, / hyphens, compound words.
Yeah.
You know, there is so much benefit in life for humans, for this human machine, this human body, to engage in activity, so to participate in being in the nature and being with the nature and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, one thing that I have found over time is that, you know, a lot of these on one end of the spectrum, the media portrayal or, you know, the you know, widely accepted social constructions or whatever we want to call it, keep people from accessing the benefits of these activities. You know what I mean? You know, what does it mean? I think in a lot of cases, what does it mean to be like physically fit? What does it mean to be healthy or something like that? And so many people will associate that, like you said, with just the best, you know, or not even the best, but just the
most highly extreme.
The dream. Yeah. Like, oh, I, you know, how many people, for example, get gym membership for Christmas and then never use it? Because nobody, not, I mean, some people really find joy from hanging out in the gym, but a very small amount compared to all of the other joyful physical activities that you can do to be healthy, to be mentally healthy, physically healthy, going for a walk, you know, hanging out in your garden, going surfing. And these aren't all things that are, you know, traditionally seen as like ways to be active and ways to gain health and wellness from physical activities. So, yeah, I think that's why, again, like, you know, we say, be careful. I know we're kind of joking, but, you know, be careful if you enjoy something and then you start researching. But I don't know, but for me, it's really important to get as many people like as possible enjoying nature and like enjoying themselves, enjoying their bodies and, you know, staying physically fit and active and healthy. And it's unfortunate that a lot of these kind of mainstream depictions and, you know, preconceived notions we have about like what it means to be fantastic at something or the best or whatever that you need to achieve is that keeps a lot of people from accessing and feeling good.
Absolutely. You know? And like, I'm an advocate for people doing whatever physical activity or movement practices that work for them. So if people want to go to the gym and they find community and mental health benefits in that, that's awesome. Sure. And they should definitely do that. For me, it's never been enough. And I really like being outside, because if my focus in physical activity is entirely about how my body looks or my body composition, I find that's really bad for my mental health. And it's not enough to keep me active. But if my motivation for my physical activity and movement practices is that I just feel good and I enjoy it and it distracts me and it makes me take time away from my phone or my computer or spend some time on my own or explore my suburb or whatever it is, then for me, that's what really works. And so, yeah, so I mean, I'm sort of like edging into the fact that I live in a city, right? So my daily physical activity is walking around my suburb. But with surfing, yeah, I mean, it really sucks when people don't want to do it, or they only want to do it if they can be good at it instantly, because like genuinely surfing is the hardest thing I've ever learned to do. And learning to do it as an adult is the most humiliating bit of ego maintenance that you could ever undertake. Like, it takes so long to be anything approximating good at it, you know, let alone mildly competent. And so you have to be really, really willing to look like just like your boobs are falling out of your top, stuff's coming out of your nose. you have no dignity. You get hit in the head by your board. You've got cuts on you from the fin. Like, you know, you have to really love it. And it has to mean so much more to you than how you look, because you wouldn't do it if you were worried about that. So unless if there's a, like when I started surfing, it was in the town where I grew up and everyone I knew was really good at it. And so it was really hard to keep paddling out in front of all my friends and be terrible at this thing that they were so good at. So I think that's one barrier. Like you're saying, like there's a perception that everyone's really good. And when you get there, you think everyone's really good because everyone's better than you anyway. But then other sports aren't like that. I mean, like I'm ocean swimming a lot more than I surf at the moment. And part of it is the inclusivity that I've found in that community. And there's things to say about that. Like when we start talking about access, we can't just talk about the culture in terms of performance. We have to talk about the identities and the people who do it. And when you talk about ocean swimming, you're talking about like just lots of white bodies, like loads of them. It's like a lot of, it must be, yeah, there's not many people of color that I see in the ocean swimming communities. Mm. And there's, you know, it's very middle class, you know, like it's done at times of day that make it hard for like maybe parents of young children to go if you're going to be in a group, because it's more done in mornings when it can be difficult. So once we start talking about access, there's a lot of other things to consider in why people might or might not engage in these sorts of sports. With ocean-based sports, there's things to consider like the wildlife, and definitely in ocean-based sports, you know, obviously fear of sharks is a really big deterrent to people participating, which seems like a really reasonable deterrent to me. Also, not having grown up on the beach and so not knowing how to read the water or being afraid of waves too. That's, I mean, the ocean's terrifying. Like, I find it not that, it took me a long time to understand that the ocean wasn't something that everyone knew how to navigate. To know how to navigate your boundaries. And I could still get caught in a rip and drown. Like, that's definitely a possibility. But I understand that that's a possibility and that that's part of the risk. And so I know how to make decisions about where to swim, when not to swim, and so on. Waves are really scary to people who haven't encountered them, because how do you, like, I taught my niece how to jump waves, you know, and how to duck them and how to feel comfortable with the sensation of being tumbled in them. So there's lots of barriers in those ocean spaces. And that's just like, we're just talking about beaches, not forests and mountains, right? That's got their own barriers. So yeah, I mean, all of that. And then for, if you've got mobility issues, sand, like, so the beaches where I grew up, they don't have ramps down to the water. Like, it's, you know, it's really difficult for people. Sand's very difficult to, soft sand's very difficult to move on. So there's, and so there's a lot of issues around that kind of access, logistical access for people too. And then in a lot of towns, it can be parking costs, you know, like, beaches are very chic. Everyone wants to go to the beach, and often they're very middle class or upper class suburbs a lot of the time. And so there's lots of deterrents to people hanging out that they don't want to be there. So there can be parking costs or timed parking as well that can make it difficult for people to be there as well. So there's all kinds of barriers to participation that, you know, we need to recognize are in place, because often when we talk about nature, it's with this idea of it's available to everyone, but it's absolutely not available to everyone, like for all kinds of reasons.
We have this kind of like monolithic things like nature, like a climbing wall, like a surfboard, whatever, and we say, oh yeah, well, all you gotta do is just get up. And it's like, no, there's a bajillion different, everybody's different, and we all have different access issues, no matter, you know, no matter where you stand in, like, you know, the line of social stratification.
Participation in those activities is also completely differently defined. So, you know, going back to your point of like how sports get represented, they're usually represented at the extreme. And I think there are shifts. And I think the cold swimming phenomenon that I've been following is a real example of that. But like for me, when I started surfing, like now I have more expectations of myself, but a good day on the surf for me is like actually just going at the moment, you know. But when I started surfing, it was really challenging to me because I grew up doing ballet and and wanting, like, being pretty invested in being a lady, a good young lady. And so to sit on a surfboard with your legs apart, straddling a surfboard in public, in swimmers, that was super confronting for me. And like, I found that really difficult. And being ugly in public. So in ballet, everything, your pain is hidden through a relaxed, gentle face. So others don't know the effort that you're using to do. I wasn't good at it, by the way. Like, I don't want anyone to mistake the fact that I was any good at this. I just did it for a really long time. I was like, yeah, fine. Like, for a country girl. But then in the surf, when you've got, like I said before, like your hair's in your face and you look, you don't look very good, and your clothes get disordered and you trip over and you fall on your face. Like, all of that, I'd never done any of that before. And this is in my mid-20s I started doing that, like about my early 20s. So, you know, that was huge for me. And so not only am I trying to figure out how you catch a wave, in terms of the logistic of the sport. I'm also trying to figure out how to feel good about these really challenging situations that were completely altering how I felt about myself and my gender, how my gender was performed. So yeah, there's like all sorts going on, and that's like a white girl, some white middle-class girl example, right, of the kinds of challenges that can happen that you don't expect by being out in those spaces. So, you know, yeah.
Do you remember, was there a time where you kind of aha moment, or like you came in contact with some experience or some theory that made you want to dig deeper into these outdoor experiences?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's really interesting. I was really interested in what surfing did in culturally. So how the sport or the activity facilitated these cultural exchanges between different kinds of people. And that's what I did my honors on. And I was just looking at young men interacting with other young men in Bali and in other places, and how surfing was this offshore space that you talk to people you don't usually talk to, because you share this identity of being a surfer in this out in the water. And then when you get back onto land, you're more willing to talk to someone because you've established a kind of connection. So to me, it was always like very cultural, and I've come to the outdoors bit a bit later. And part of that, I think, was when I moved to Brisbane. It's going to be a bit of a meandering story because it came through a different, like this weird way, but I moved to Brisbane and so lived 2 hours away, and I was doing my PhD and I had no money, so I couldn't afford the petrol to go to the beach. And when I went back to my hometown, I was there and there was this graffiti one day I saw saying, "Save Broken Head," my local beach, "Save Broken, stay in Brisbane." So there was this localism that was happening there against people who live in Brisbane. So I looked at it and in this moment realized what is that actually saying? Like, how do I fit in this picture now? Who am I here? Am I the local or am I the Brisbane person? And I realized I was both. And I'd been surfing with all these people in Brisbane who know the coast so well, and they love it and care about it so much. And I just felt so angry at that, like that they thought that just because you don't live in the town, you can't love and care for a place. And so it was that, actually, that graffiti and that moment that made me go, lots of people can care for these places. And that it was the draw to the coast through the physical activity, through the sport, the leisure activity, whatever you want to call surfing in this case, that really gave people the chance to learn about different coastal areas and to come to love them and want to protect them. And so that was my pathway, was looking at the ugly cultural politics that gave me a doorway into thinking about how they connected with more environmental ecological aspects.
Yeah, it's local versus global. always a conflict. We want to stay local, but at the same time, we got to think globally, literally and figuratively.
Well, the localism that I was looking at is about authority. Like, who has the authority and the rights? Who has the right to even surf in a place, you know, to want to talk about access, right? Like, just because you surf at a place every day, like just because you have that access, you want to shut out other people. And I remember surfing one day and it was really small. There was just one little wave breaking. There was loads of people out and you could only get a go on the wave every so often. And this person I was really good friends with, he paddled out and he just took it and then he paddled straight back out and take. And I'm using the word take really, you know, I mean to use that word because he didn't let anyone else get a wave the whole time he was out there. It was really awful. And he just had this look on his face and I was like, "What are you doing?" And he goes, "Well, I've only had the chance to surf once today and I need to get as many waves as I can." And again, in that moment, I just thought, wow, imagine that. Like, imagine feeling like that, you just deserve this because you had to work today so you didn't get to surf in the early morning. And so all of that stuff just started to make me ask other questions of it about like how we take care of places, how we treat them, how the issues of access and localism tie in with that. Yeah, so it was maybe a different kind of pathway into thinking about the politics of environmentalism.
When I tell people, oh, I studied in outdoor studies, and they always think that that means that you are going to be some kind of kayak guide or, you know, tour guide or something, which I am a guide. Yeah, I always thought of it definitely more in a kind of social studies kind of way, you know, social science, environment, outdoors. This is also part of the society. It's almost, in some ways, maybe I'm biased, but could be the ultimate social study because we're all here swimming around because we're all here on Earth. You know, I first found out about you through this paper called Swimming with Sharks.
Is that what it was? Living with Sharks.
Living with Sharks. And I was rereading this again recently, and, you know, it seems like a very multi-layered but concise and compact article. So I recommend everybody going out and getting an issue of the White Horses magazine to check it out.
My blog now.
It's on your blog. Yeah. All right. It presents, of course, a depiction of the place that you were writing about, which was, again, what was it? I forget exactly the place.
Byron Bay in southeast Queensland, the Gold Coast.
I was going to say Byron Bay. and a very great place to kind of talk about ecofeminism, because kind of to a broader audience, let's say. And can you just like give us like a little situation of what's happening in Byron Bay that you talk about in this article with the sharks, with the people, and where ecofeminism fits into this?
Sure. So in the area that I live in, so southeast Queensland, or that I surf and swim in, southeast Queensland, northern New South Wales, there's been a number of shark bites and shark encounters, and a number of those have been fatal. So I think last year in Australia, there were 8 fatalities from shark bites. And so it's a really big topic for people who use the ocean a lot. This is, it's quite real, you know, this threat. Even if you can't see sharks, they might be thinking about them more. And in the last few years, it's really become something that people are talking about a lot, they're thinking about a lot, and it's impacting how they surf. And one of the responses to this, and this goes back to the 1930s when these first nets went in, was nets. That they're like these sort of submerged nets that don't go to the bottom of the ocean floor. I think I can't remember how long they are, like 60 meters long maybe, or maybe a bit longer. So they're just like this hanging net in the ocean that's there to give a perception of safety. But all the evidence shows that they just kill lots of other animals. So in this area, they kill humpback whales, they kill dolphins, they kill endangered, they do kill sharks, but they kill a lot of endangered species. They kill stingrays, they kill turtles, they kill, you know, all kinds of animals get trapped in these nets because they're just hanging in the water. And of course, a lot of animals swim around them too. So at the moment, there's these debates about thinking about how should we be responding to the threat of sharks. And it's not just a threat, because people have died from shark bites in the area as well. So I'm trying to think through the ethics of that. Some people just want to cull, that we should cull targeted culls of particular shark species, in particular great white sharks, tiger sharks, and I think it's bulls, which are the species most commonly associated with biting humans. But then others are very opposed to this and say, well, it's their space, and if you want to be in the ocean, you need to accept that. So I'm really interested in thinking that through and interrogating my position on that too, because I'm really scared in the water a lot. Like now, I didn't used to be, but I think about it a lot when I'm in the water. But do I think that the life of these amazing creatures, these huge, incredible creatures, sharks, that they should be killed so that I can partake in a leisure activity? Like, do I think that? And for me, the answer is no. But I'm talking to a lot of people to try and understand why others think the answer is yes. So genuinely, without judgment, I want to understand these different perspectives. And so this has led me to think more about the ethics of how we live in environments. And So my starting point for thinking about ethics and politics was feminism. And so I wanted to expand on that because for me, that's a real foundation stone because it reminds me to always think about politics and ethics and power. And so I started looking at kinds of feminism that engage with more ecological politics. So ecofeminism is a really, really good one. And what's really, just as a little diversion down that path, is ecofeminism extends on the idea that we need to think about the inequalities and oppressions amongst people and to think about the inequalities between people and nature spaces. But good ethical ecofeminism doesn't just stop at sex and gender when it thinks about power. It also thinks about colonial, in the case of Australia, let's say, colonial politics or the politics of black bodies in spaces or the politics of sexuality, you know, as we were talking about before, like the multiple politics. But once you start talking about land and ecology and place, when you live in a country shaped by colonization, which so many, you know, of us do, it becomes really important to think about the politics of that. So I found ecofeminism really useful because it pushes me to go past myself, to go past the things that I see immediately around me and to start working to critique my position and to understand the position of the people who were in this, who were here before colonization. So in this case, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Yeah, so that's kind of like a little riff on that theory. And yeah, and so I am like a lot of the ecofeminists I've been looking at are also to interrogate whiteness and white supremacy. So Indigenous and First Nations scholars are doing this really well, right? So Dina Gillio Whittaker and Karen Ingersoll and Robin Kimmerer are doing this work. Like they're quite well-known names who are doing this work. But if I'm going to interrogate like what underpins the nature-human divide as I try and understand the right to life of sharks, the spiritual element of a lot of those ontologies is really difficult for me, and also I don't have a genealogical claim to the kinds of knowledges that are drawn on. So for Indigenous Australians, to talk about a relationship to place is to talk about ancestors, and that go back, you know, 60,000 years. It's to talk to being of the land, not just living on it, of being part of it and in an ancestral sense. So to being connected in these really deep ways. And I can't make those claims. So if I want to really challenge the human nature divide where humans are separated from the ecologies that in this case we must swim and surf in, for me, those white feminists have been really important. So the Indigenous feminists have been, or Indigenous scholars have been really important in making the critique and highlighting everything to me. Those like the politics of place. But as I interrogate my own ontology, it's people like Val Plumwood and Anna Singh and Donna Haraway who've been super important in helping me start to break that down in myself in a way that really resonates so that I can get to a place of shared knowledge. So with the sharks, I was like, okay, well, how can I think about this differently? And they're not my ancestors, so I can't like co-opt that because it suits me and I want to feel that way. So the history, you know, Val Plumwood shows in her work, she shows that the nature-culture divide is a result of Western philosophy, of sexist Western philosophy that saw the human as above nature. So it put civilization and art and, you know, so on and philosophy above living in the natural world. And then the natural world came associated with women and femininity. So there's this double thing happening that's both sexist and white supremacist at once. So, you know, it's like great. So she really unpacked that in a way that made sense to me and helped me understand my own assumptions about the world. And then starts to go, well, how can we fix, like, how can we challenge this from that position? And so I found this like work that she's, or well, Val Plumwood has passed away, the work she's done in the past where she talks about the need for challenging and chastening experiences in order to really challenge that divide in our lives, in our everyday lived experience, has been really interesting to me. And that's where the thing around sharks becomes really interesting, because even if you don't see them, the idea of a shark and the threat of a shark and a shark bite and the idea of dying mm-hmm. from another animal biting you or consuming you, that is a chastening experience. Like, that really challenges your idea of humans as separate from ecologies and dominant over them. So being immersed in water for me is a really great way of constantly reminding myself of my vulnerability, of my fragility, of the fact that I am part of these ecologies, you know, in lots of different ways. And it's a pretty sort of dramatic one in lots of ways.
you might be someone's meal, you know, you never know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but, you know, and that's not to anthropomorphize sharks, to go that, you know, there's sharks, they're just not personal. They're not going, oh, mm-hmm. that Rebecca Roloff, like, she drew a piece of work, I'm going to go get her. Like, that's not what's happening.
They're just hangry, you know?
Or they're curious as well. Like, yeah. That's why I keep saying, I'm not saying shark attack. Like, shark attacks will happen, but a lot of the time they're bites that are very unfortunate, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want that to happen to me. I'm not saying that. And I'm not saying that I want it to happen to other people. I'm just trying to understand the ethics of these relationships and what they can teach us. So at this point, am I comfortable with the ideas of sharks being culled so that I can feel a greater sense of safety when I surf or swim? No, I'm not. Am I still scared of sharks when I'm in the water? Yeah, I am. And is that a productive way to feel? Yeah. And not everyone feels like that. Like, the people I swim with, a lot of them do feel that way, the same as me, but a lot of them don't. They've really made a peace with it that I find really incredible and inspiring, to be honest. Yeah. And so then, like, that sort of comes back to what I've been reading with Donna Haraway as well. And she says that if we want to really change, and again, this is like really, this isn't talking to Indigenous and First Nations peoples, they understand this. This is talking to especially white settler people, but some other cultures as well. But if we really want to change our relationship to the world, we need to think about making kin with the animals and plants that we coexist with the multi-species world that we live in. So we need to think of them not as something we dominate, but as something we have a relationship to. And yeah, so I find that really helpful too. Yeah, so they've been like really key in the work that I'm doing around sharks. So if I think of sharks as an animal that I share the world with, that are, you know, part of that world, it just starts to shift my thinking about my place in ecologies. Is that?
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, that kind of explains the title of this article, which I think could be interpreted in many ways, which is basically living with sharks. Mm-hmm. So staying with the trouble, kind of like you said, I don't want to be eaten by a shark, but at the same time, I know that it might be a possibility, or like that's a real thing that could happen. It's a very realistic approach to the situation. I mean, well, it's realistic. You can say, well, I like you said, some of your friends, they're at peace with, maybe that will happen one day. I don't know, but I just love to surf anyways, you know? but talking about just like...
It also stops because you have to go, you know, we were talking earlier about learning how to look at the ocean and understand that drowning is something that can happen. Even when you're super experienced, you can still drown. So you go, oh, there's a rip there, I won't swim there. Or, oh, the waves are pretty big, they're probably a bit beyond my capability, and I might just stay in because I don't want to accept that risk. Well, it's the same if you went now, there's a lot more discussion about, well, maybe you don't get to surf whenever you want. So if you don't want to encounter a shark, don't surf after a big rainfall, especially near a river mouth. There was a whale washed up at a beach, like some beaches down from like some popular surf beaches, and the advice was you just shouldn't surf at the moment if you don't want to encounter sharks, because that whale carcass on the beach is bleeding into the sea and it's attracting a lot more sharks to the area. So, you know, this might not be a good time to surf. Don't go near a bait ball. So when you see lots of birds diving into the water getting fish from a huge ball, called a bait ball of different kinds of fish, that's probably not necessarily a great idea to surf or swim near that either. So it's also starting to read and navigate things and understand you don't always get to do what you want to do just because you want to. And like, that's not an unreasonable thing. Like, that's not an unreasonable way to live in the world, is that you don't always get to do what you want to do.
I'm not in charge of the word sustainability, but I would say that this is sounds like a very sustainable idea. Yeah. That's what we're all about here on this podcast, is promoting sustainability. I'm just going to throw in a quick transnatural perspective, which it sounds like I might be reaching, but just go with me for a second. So similarly, somewhat similarly, here in Oslo, you know, cross-country skiing, big thing. It's, I'd say, one of the great, I can't think of a greater place in the world to go cross-country skiing. Awesome activity, pretty low-key, doesn't involve a lot of equipment. We're not talking downhill skiing right now. And there's just, you know, mountains all around town, and you can ski wherever you want, and you can take the train and go skiing. It's awesome. Big part of also national identity here in Norway is being out on the skis and going all these places. Now, we have a problem here called climate change, and that makes it so there's less, that makes it so there's less snow a lot of the time. Every year we see it, there's less and less snow. And I remember from the moment I came here about 6 years ago, there was all this talk about, oh, this kind of wrestling between like what to do about the less snow, because, you know, the people, we can no longer go skiing as much. And like, that's what we do here in Norway. We go skiing, you know? So for a while, I'm not sure if this is still happening, there was an initiative going on to pave certain parts of the forest so people could roller ski when there's no snow.
Right.
So, yeah. So, I mean, yes, we have this kind of like cultural human thing that says, and I'm sorry, there might be some people out there that find my statement controversial, but I'm going to say there might be this cultural thing that says like, oh, we are Norwegian, we go skiing. But the nature is saying, no, 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 you can't go skiing right now. You know, it's not. And then they say, well, no, that's too bad. We're going to pave tracks where there used to be ski tracks, and we're going to go roller skiing here. It's again, I mean, it's a sticky situation, especially here. It might sound kind of ridiculous in other parts of the world, but it's a sticky situation here, because it's like people are like, this is my culture, this is my identity, and I just feel I have the privilege to do this, or maybe I have the...
But this is one of those tensions too, when we talk about, we promote being outdoors and doing physical activity is so important for us and for our everyday physical, mental, emotional, social health. And so people are doing that, and then suddenly that can't happen. And so they're trying to make sense of that too. So, I mean, I don't know, like, it might be that they've done, I'm intuitively not a fan of the idea of putting down those tracks, but it would be really interesting to see any of the research about environmental impact, because it might be that those tracks create maybe less impact in how people move through a space, so they're more directed through a space. True. And I don't know, that's a really interesting one. Like,
yeah, it was really interesting. And actually, I don't want to sound like too much like I'm knocking on the idea, because I mean, like you said, it could be very interesting to find out, you know, how this works out and what is this a benefit? I mean, are more people going roller skiing now or anything? But yeah, I mean, just the when you think about the kind of the actual activity of like, yeah, I'm gonna, for example, I don't care about that there's shark, I'm gonna jump into shark infested waters. I just want to go surfing right now. Or like, no, I don't care that the whole reason I can't go skiing is because the climate is changing, so I'm gonna pave over the forest, you know, or something like that. And I would say, actually, maybe I'm sensationalizing a bit right now. Like, that is kind of like a very big drastic kind of dichotomy thing, visualization juxtaposition.
No, they're gonna resonate right with now, each other. I mean, if you're gonna surf, you're encountering sharks, you don't know it, but you are.
Yeah. And when you're going skiing in the forest, you're gonna inevitably find garbage from skiers, which has always been kind of funny for me, which I've written about a little bit. But just to like back up a little bit too, you know, I just wanted to kind of like clarify, because I've used different like perspectives from this idea of ecofeminism, or this like school of ecofeminism, in a lot of my work, and just influences me in my life. But could you like help us summarize maybe just like a little bit like define this term a little bit? Because I feel like in many cases it gets misinterpreted and people kind of don't know what it means.
Well, feminism for me, and you know, feminism likes to say that feminism is a broad school of thought, but for me in the end, feminism is about equity and diversity with sex and gender as a starting point. So it starts from the assumption that the world is an inequitable place and that, that inequality is based on patriarchy, which is the idea that the world was designed for a very small group of people and they designed it into order to retain power with themselves. And these people happen to be the most, like happen to be men, but they're also usually the most able-bodied, they're, you know, privileged in financially and so on. So it's very easy for them to hold on to power. This isn't great for women. These guys don't want women to interrupt that power and the way things are. But equally, it's not that great for men either. Like it's only good for that small group of men. So the version of feminism that I subscribe to, and like I said, other people have different versions of feminism, but mine is that it's actually about critiquing patriarchy as being problematic for all different kinds of people. So improving women's lives and opportunities and access to the world improves men's lives too. Now, an example of that would be, off the top of my head, parental leave. So as women have fought to have leave from their, to stay in their jobs when they have children, like to not have to leave their job and to be able to have time off when they have a baby. And then also now to have in Australia, and I think Scandinavia is really good at this too, paid time off when they have a baby. That means that's been really great for them. But over time too, women have paid, have fought for men to be able to have access to that too, for men to be able to have time off to spend with their children away from their workplace as well. Does that example make sense? So yeah. And it, like in surfing, if we've got more room, like if there's more room for women to have a say in how the surf break is run. And in the case of my project, the women I talked with, they didn't want to just be given access to the surf break. That wasn't their goal. Their goal was to not surf like the guys who were dominating and controlling the culture of the surf break to be exclusive. So they didn't want to just do things that way and be accepted in to the existing shitty culture. Sorry for swearing. They wanted, they wanted to change the culture so that it was more welcoming and accessible for more different kinds of people. So they, their thing was, I don't want to tell anyone how to surf. I just don't want them to surf like those guys. And they meant like the dominant guys who took everything and treated people badly. So for me, that's what feminism's about. So it's about just making the world a nicer place for more people and destroying the patriarchy. And so ecofeminism then is about extending that to understand that women are complicit in a lot of the patriarchy, including different aspects of the white, of the patriarchy that extend to our relationships to ecologies. And as I said, instantly that takes us to issues of colonization. It takes us to issues of politics around race and ethnicity, sexuality, of ability. And so for me, ecofeminism opens up to thinking about these, all the ways that human relationships to nature have been limited by different kinds of oppression. And like I said, you can come at this from all, you can come at this from all different kinds of starting points and end up at the same place as me. It's just that because I started with feminism and that shaped my politics so strongly, it's remained the foundation stone from which I continue to build and expand. So, you know, my surfing project was absolutely super white and neoliberal. Like, look, I didn't know that at the time. And as soon as I finished, I just was like, oh my God, you know, look what I've done. I am the stereotype. And so I started reading, like, you know, a lot of critiques from queer women. I started looking at sexuality a lot more. And then I started reading a lot of Australian Indigenous women's perspectives and critiques as well of white feminism. So that's like some examples of what I've been reading to start like challenging myself, because it's not enough what I was doing. And so ecofeminism is another strand to that, which is pushing me to think about the ethical relationships that I have to the world around me and to ask questions of that.
Yeah. So one thing I'm thinking, because I mean, and I know that we're going to get into it in a little bit too, because I know that you also have a big interest in media. Okay, so of course, nowadays, if you go on social media, or like, I mean, if you go in the real world too, or, well, they're kind of both part of the real world.
But, they're both the real world, yeah.
They're both the real world, yeah. So, yeah, very real world. Yeah. There's so much just crazy conceptions about feminism and like people around the world that are just not open to this idea, and a lot of tropes and stereotypes of people that subscribe to these kinds of ideas, me being one of them.
Look, anytime someone tells you that you're complicit in a system of oppression, that feels terrible to be told that. No one wants to hear that. You feel shame, you feel anger, you feel misunderstood. Like, it sucks to be told that. And I mean, and people respond really badly to that. And the most recent example of how we've like, yes, certainly, like, I've had really bad responses to standing up and saying, hey, surfing's really sexist. I mean, I don't see that as a controversial statement. It's actually just a statement of fact. And people get angry, and men get angry, women get angry, because they don't want to hear it. It's very difficult to hear. And I like, and then to be told that you're complicit in a problem. And Black Lives Matter has really shown that too. So in the Black Lives Matter movement, you see lots of activists talking about, you know, they'll post stuff online and they get all these, like, say for Black feminists or Black women, they'll get lots of white women taking up the space or asking them to do extra work or disagreeing, because suddenly white women are being held accountable for being complicit in systems of oppression too, and they don't like it. We don't like it. Like, you know, I should include me in that too. So people just react really badly. And it's the same with, like, thinking about ecologies. Look, I'm not a vegetarian, for example. And I think about that a lot. And, you know, when people, like, I mean, I don't eat a lot of meat, but do I always know where the meat comes from? Can I be sure that it's not coming from farms that are treating animals massively unethically? Like, no. Mm-hmm. And so I have to accept that I'm complicit in this system of oppression for different animals as well. So if you're not comfortable with admitting that, if you're not comfortable with, if you haven't thought through that and how you fit into that, you can react really badly. And I think what we need to understand is when someone says to us, you're part of a system of oppression, to continue with that sentence, it's not entirely personal. Like, they're talking about you being part of a system that, you know, that affects us all. Like, me continue, like, me, say I eat heaps of meat from animals that are factory farmed. That's terrible for those animals. And it's terrible for the bigger picture of the entire world. Like, we're all, it doesn't help any of us for me to engage in those practices. Does that make sense? Do I want to be yelled at for it? No, not all the time. Do I need to learn how to be yelled at and told that I'm part of this? Yes, absolutely. And so I'm more practiced at that. And sometimes I react badly to stuff still too, like we all do. But you've just got to learn to be able to go, yeah, I'm wrong about this, and I really need to listen to what this person's saying and to take them seriously and show them the respect to hear their point of view and to hear their wisdom and their knowledge and to take it on and to sit with it for a while, staying with the trouble, as you said before, which is like, the, you know, Donna Haraway's line. And it's difficult work, you know. Yeah, it's really difficult work doing that. So I understand when people react really badly to being told that some of the behaviors they engage in are really problematic, because I don't like it when people say that to me either. But we just need to get better at it and learn how to hear it, stay with it, and then not only stay with it, but change our behavior or be able to justify why we're not and live with that, accept that by not changing our behavior, we're continuing to be part of the problem.
Yeah, I think critical thinking and critical receiving of critical thinking is also, you know, important part of the process.
Well, I was reading today. I forget the author's name, but I'll find it and give you the link to share with people listening. And she was critiquing ecofeminism because she's saying that ecofeminism has the capacity to just reproduce the very problems that they're trying to change, because they're not listening to Indigenous and First Nations, especially women in this case. So they're just speaking over and for women without listening and understanding that their worldview is different and diverse. And so there's got to be a lot more listening done. And, you know, these are really great and important critiques that are being made that you need to sit with, you know, or we need to sit with in order to really understand them and know how to process them effectively in a way that helps contribute to the kind of change that we want to see. And a lot of the time what's difficult is that you realize that you have to give something up or you have to change something about yourself. And sometimes you don't want to do it, you know? So you have to decide, well, do you want the world to change? Do you want communities and places to change for better? Or do you want to hold on to this thing that you're unreasonably attached to? Like being able to surf when I want to surf, right?
Something for me, one of the most interesting things about this is that if you look throughout time, if you look throughout history, social movements, social occurrences, the ways that people are interacting with each other, the way that humans treat non-humans, the way that humans treat the natural world is very much entwined in this idea of that which we feminize and that which we, in many cases, that which we feminize is considered to be something lower, something to be discriminated against.
You know? Or something sacred that needs to be, you know, put on a pedestal.
Exactly.
As well, and this is one of the problems I have, like, personally, with a lot of the more contemporary spiritualities about the Gaia stuff and women and wellness. Mm-hmm. And women are more connected to nature and they understand it better. Because, like, if you want to buy into that, and if you want to say that women are not just more connected to Mother Nature, then you need to, like, you can't be super upset about the flip side of that either. So, you know, men are really connected to the natural world as well. Gender doesn't exist beyond human constructions. Like, it's a performance of a body under particular kinds of terms. So there are things around female bodies and childbirth that I don't have children, so I don't know, I haven't experienced, I don't understand, that women can find very sacred and connecting to ecologies in different ways, but I can't really speak for that. But in terms of like the idea of how we see nature as something to be dominated, we already start seeing gendered language, like,
exactly,
it's dominated, it's got to be taken care of. I mean, this is how women were treated for a really long time. But we also see, like, in terms of, it's also, like, nature's sometimes portrayed, and this happens in sport too, like, I'm going to conquer that mountain, I'm going to slash that wave, I'm going to, you know, so there's these really kind of like frontier terms in lots of ways, like this idea of nature is a space of frontier and survival, and it's hostile to human life, and we're at war with it because otherwise it's going to overtake us. And, you know, you see, like, I saw an article today, this abandoned Chinese fishing village has been reclaimed by nature, and or during the pandemic, nature is healing, we are the virus, you know, all these kinds of narratives that if you take humans out, there's some kind of like return to the way it's meant to be. But people are part of ecologies now. Cities aren't going anywhere. We need to do them better. We need to be more ethical in the way we produce waste, in the way we consume things, in the way we, you know, and that includes the way we produce power, our extractive practices. You know, we need to think more carefully about those too. The way we have families, that's part of Haraway's point too. Like, need to rethink our models of how we have families, which is really radical. And it's really radical to some people too. So that's where it starts to intersect with queer studies as well, I think. You know, the critiquing of the sort of nuclear family as well. So, yeah, it's like those gender critiques of how we think about nature is so, to me, they make so much sense and they help explain a lot.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, why I think that this is so important, really, when we are talking about ecofeminism, it has a lot to do with, you know, are you trying to dominate the natural world, or are you trying to be a part of it?
Yeah, it's a rethinking of the ethics of those relationships, the ethics and the politics of those relationships. And to do that is to really challenge the way things are done. And the way things are done right now is it's not going to keep working, you know? And that includes, like, as I said, it's gender is a starting point for that. Sex and gender is a starting point for that, but that expands. You can't talk about sex and gender without talking about sexuality, you know? Mm-hmm. And you know, if you're going to live in a place like Australia and you're a white settler, you can't talk about that without thinking about being a settler politics. You can't think about that without thinking about colonization and the treatment of Indigenous Australians. You can't think about any of this without thinking about what it means to have mobility issues or a disability or some kind of impairment that shapes your relationship to the world. And, you know, I mean, it's an interesting time because one of the things that has been said a lot, and I'm in Australia where our COVID situation is pretty good, like where we have mostly freedom of movement, and that's a whole other discussion, but that I just want to recognize that, understanding that not everyone has that. But this situation that we're living in internationally has amplified, is often the thing that gets said. It's not revealing new problems. It's amplifying the problems that already existed. Like, who are vulnerable people when it comes to health and healthcare, and, you know, how do we treat people, and what's the ethics of our aged care systems? You know, like, all these kinds of things are really standard. We think we know that being in outdoor spaces is like a good option for exercising, that going for walks or being near the sea or those kinds of things really good. So then who has access to those spaces? Who has access to inner city? Who lives near parks where you can go? If you have to stay local in your area and you're not allowed to move around so much as is happening in lockdowns, then, you know, who's being taken care of in different ways in terms of the infrastructure that they have access to? Have they got trees around them that they can even see from their, you know, homes? Have they got, like, I live in the inner city in a, you know, like, internationally small city, but there's, my view is across trees. I have an amazing view of the sky. It's a 10-minute walk for me to be in a park that a creek runs through that's full of mangroves, and I live in the inner city. Now, that's a really privileged position to be in, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. So, like, this is what, like, for me, these authors that I've been reading, the critiques of the authors that I've been reading as well, have really led me to think about really deeply, is those everyday privileges that shape my relationship to the world, and who else do I want to have access to these things, and, like, who doesn't have access to them, and who does my access, like, if I have access to these things, what is that shutting down for other people?
Right.
Yeah. So it's like there's not much comfort in it. If you're looking for, like, a position of comfort where you can just sit and feel good, smug about yourself, this is definitely not the kind of work that people would want to undertake, because you don't get to just stop. You don't get to reach a point where you're like, oh, well, I'm in the right now. Like, I know the best way to live in the world, because there's always another thing that you're missing. You know, there's always another piece. There's always something you can do better. And maybe that sounds exhausting, but I actually find that, like, that's how I want to be in the world.
Oh, it sounds fantastic. I totally understand. I mean, you know, I can relate to it. I sit here and I think, okay, I live, you know, I can see the fjord from here. I'm not like by any means like a well-to-do person, but I mean, you know, around the world, I see the fjord, you know, from my window. That's incredible. I don't know how that ever happened. Like, I have buses and trains like all around here. I can hike a little mountain that's like 10 minutes over there. And, you know, I just happen to be here. And that's the key. I just happen to be here. There's certain reasons why, you know, maybe I happen to be here, but in the end, we're all just very lucky or luckier, and, you know, whatever our position might be.
And it's also about not romanticizing distant places as being the perfect outdoor space as well, but understanding that we have things around us that we can enjoy and that are beautiful. And you know, that inner city creek that I live near, it's super polluted. I wouldn't be able to swim in it. It's got loads of agricultural runoff from, you know, upstream. There's often rubbish in it. There's scum on the surface, you know. And so there's things that could be improved about the health of that creek. But nonetheless, I find so much joy in being able to go down there and hear the sound of rain on water, or to see trees growing out of it that are, you know, cleaning that water as they go, of seeing the ducks swimming around, of, I don't know, of the, of all the different things that are there. So it's no, probably not many people's ideal of the kind of nature space that they want to access. But I live in the city where I'm able to have a job that I enjoy, and I have great friends, and I have access to like lots of galleries and museums and things. And in addition to that, I also have access to these parks that they're not ideal, you know, in terms of like how you'd want to draw the creek that you want to hang out in, but they bring me great joy and I feel really lucky. And so, you know, I don't want to end this thinking that I'm advocating for some kind of romanticized notion of the outdoors, because as long as I've got a view of the sky, I feel pretty good, or I'm able to see up into, you know, look at the sunset and see the clouds. I feel really lucky about that. But yeah, it's understanding that nature, use that word, manifests in all kinds of ways that humans are living with. So,
yeah, I think that's really important, is not to romanticize so much, but, you know, be happy with what we have. I'm a big advocate, as I've talked about on this program before, about the idea of adventure around the corner. It's another nice way of, some people say, you know, place-based experiences. But, you know, because most people around the world are living in cities and it's continuing up. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, getting outside. A lot of the times today we're talking about getting outside in an urban area. I believe you mentioned earlier, Mike Brown told me one time that they were always taking the students out to some faraway place, like 6 hours away, to go whitewater rafting or something. But then one day they were like, why don't we take them surfing? We can go surfing right here. And that's not, you know, maybe that's not in like the British tradition of outdoor education, which, you know, is heavily influential, but that's here in Australia, or by the beach, you know, save the river 6 hours away for the people that live over there, you know. And nice to go to these places.
There's other costs, you know, to that too. So if I want to drive to the beach, I'm in my car using fuel, and, you know, so there's my tires are shedding like plastic into the waterways that inevitably run next to the highways. So there's all these kinds of little costs as well for me to go surfing that add up over time. But for me to, on foot, walk down to the waterway down here, maybe pick up some trash if I see it. I mean, people take pretty good care of it, but that's a very low impact activity in comparison that I can get loads of joy out of, and that it's a different kind of joy, you know, but it's way more accessible, and it's always there for me right there, like 10 minute walk down there. And on that 10 minute walk, it's on roads, but I'm walking past people's gardens and they grow the most beautiful plants. And, you know, there's neighborhood cats walking around and they'll come up and say hi and I get to know them. And okay, those cats kill birds, but there's loads of birds around too. So I'll hear kookaburras laughing and I'll hear magpies warbling and I'll get swooped by a bird maybe too, which is terrifying, but also part of living in an ecology, you know. So, and I see the houses also, these beautiful houses that so beautifully designed and that people take such pride in and they take care of. So I get so much joy out of all these different elements of the walk just to get to the creek. Yeah, I've really, living in the city is really, for someone who grew up on a beach that was, when I was young, it was a pretty isolated beach. It's not so much anymore. It's really busy. But to have learned to find so much joy in the inner city, that took me a while. But I feel like no one can ever take that from me. I'll always be able to find that in the different places I go. If I can find it, you know, like I said, it's why I've become so, I love looking up at the sky and seeing clouds. And I'm lucky, I live in a city with pretty clear air, so the sky is always available to me. I can always look up and find freedom there and imagination there. Even if I'm surrounded by buildings, I can see up to that space. Yeah.
Like, do you see a role of leisure in terms of like achieving like you know, sociocultural and ecological sustainability?
I mean, my argument is that it's really important to that, that giving people the opportunity to have these, well, we talked about chastening experiences, but also deeply pleasurable experiences in outdoor spaces, it changes, it can change your relationship to it. So you have an encounter that can be profound or it can be simple, and it makes you think differently. Or you see an animal that you really liked, so you look up what it is, and then you might learn something about it. So there's that kind of like aspect to it. It being in water and the feel, like taking time to be in water, for me, it's getting away from devices. Like, it's really important. But like being in a different element where I am not in control of what happens, and where I'll be paying attention to the different ways that light plays out, different ways of the, like different temperatures, and having to adapt my behavior and make decisions about how I engage in places for pleasure, like to take my pleasure and leisure and realizing that, yeah, I can't always do it the way I want to do it. I think that's like, that's no small thing. Yeah. So my argument is that engaging in sports that happen and leisure activities that happen in outdoor spaces, in nature spaces, is actually should be encouraged, and it should be better facilitated by councils and governments and community organizations and by the sports and leisure activities themselves, because doing these activities is actually good for the spaces in return. So I get so much out of going swimming, for example, like going ocean swimming. I get so much out of that. I feel good. I'm meeting up with some friends. I'm seeing some fish or a stingray or something, and I get out of the water and I'm buzzing, and the temperature of the water makes me feel really good, and the salt and the minerals in the water is really good for me. Like, I get so much out of going swimming. So in return, I want to take care of that place. Like, I don't want it to be ruined and dead, because then I'm not going to be able to participate in it. So in a way, it's kind of a selfish, I guess, like a self-centered kind of like way of thinking about it. But you really come to care about the places. And for me, it's like learning to be willing to make the sacrifices that are needed in my consumption practices, and in order to take better care of those places. So I don't go to the beach as much, and in part that's a decision to use my car less. So no, I'm not getting to go to the beach as much as I'd like, but that's part of like the trade-off for me as well. Like, that's definitely been a decision that I've made living here. So yeah, I think that sport and leisure has a really important role to play, because we know it's really good for our health in lots of different ways. There's so much pleasure involved in it as well. And it's also all about navigating different kinds of politics, social and cultural politics as well. And in about, it's another way of understanding issues of access, equity, diversity and inclusion in society.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, this is all the kind of the magical stuff that happens, all the thinking and the thoughts that come out of having leisure time. And I think that, you know, one important thing too is, you know, a lot of people had to fight or, you know, lobby, you know, protest, become very active and to get leisure time, you know, and that's something that I think, you know, we don't associate so much with the benefits of leisure time.
No ultimate purpose. Like me going for a swim, I swim again, I'm not an athlete. Like, I don't swim to be fast, to win the swim with the people I go with. I go to swim to feel good in my body and to move it in different ways and to float for a while and to like change my perspective and to feel good. You know, it's,
yeah.
Yeah. It's really,
and I think like, you know, like the question too is like, when I think, you know, I know it's different in Australia, it's different everywhere, but especially if I just think about back in the United States, where, you know, they're still fighting, we're still fighting to get $15 an hour, yeah. And, you know, still fighting to get, you know, paid leave and all this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, I mean, one result of that too is like, oh, if you get $15 an hour, or really it should be like $25 an hour, but if you get enough money to live, then you don't have to work all the time. And then maybe you get some leisure time, and then maybe you have time to rest and think, and you can go hiking or biking, or you can just sit at home, whatever you want to do. But you have time to actually care about perhaps making the world a better place. That could be one benefit, you know. And but so one way we can also
have a bunch to say about that. I think, yeah.
But yeah, because I don't know, I just think because sometimes, you know, I think a lot of people that do have time to think about this kind of stuff, I think there is this concern, oh, well, why don't these other people, like, you know, recycle more or, you know, be more healthy? And I'm like, well, it's because they work three jobs and they're sitting in factories all day long, and when they get home they're tired and they can't. So it'd also be good to get these, that get all of the classes kind of have some more leisure time.
Well, know, and also more. That it's actually, we can't solve the problem without change at the top, right? Like, yes, I want to see, I think that kind of activism is really important for advocating for change. That's where it's going to come from, because it's not going to come from companies. They're not going to change their production practices without us not buying the products or, you know, turning away from the company. Governments, they take so long to make change. Like, it's got to be such a large volume of the population who's agitating for change for governments to do anything. So it is really about populations being much more activist, I think mm-hmm. on a much larger scale, because it can feel really overwhelming. Like, I can use my Keep Cup and my reusable bags and try and drive less, and that's great. But mm-hmm. like, ultimately, I mean, that in and of itself doesn't make me feel hopeful. It just makes me feel good about myself, you know? And, like, I don't feel happy saying that, but yeah. So getting more people to want to take more care and to be willing to make the kinds of sacrifices that are necessary to not consume as much, for example. Yeah. But consumption has its pleasures too, unfortunately.
Yeah. I'm just imagining, like, you know, through this kind of, you know, work or through this kind of perspectives that we can gain through having, like, you know, leisure time is like a privilege in many ways, because, yeah, not everybody has leisure time and not everybody can explore these things. That, you know, in many ways, you know, I think, for example, I don't know how, where the middle is really of what would be sustainable for everybody to have. But
yeah, I mean, it depends. You know, some people are like, just burn it down. We need to burn this down and we need to start again. Like, you know, like, and they're not wrong. Like, they're totally not wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, the system has to change. Yeah. These systems have to change. And I guess that's what a lot of the work that I'm reading is really about. It's like, not just changing individual behavior. That's like, the change in individual behavior has to be towards a much bigger systematic change.
As we say on this podcast, we can attack from all sides, from whichever position we happen to be in right now today, so everybody can start to live a more sustainable life. Before we end this conversation, I should say, is there anything else you would like to tell people about, or maybe tell people about, you know, where to follow you or other your websites and whatnot?
Yeah. Okay. Well, probably the easiest way, if you want to find out more about my work, is a website, movingoceans.com. And Moving Oceans is the name of my current project. So that'll be where I'll update information and share things as they start happening, and you can get a better sense of what it is that I'm working on with that. So yeah, movingoceans.com is where all my work sort of aggregated at the moment.
Dr. Rebecca Ahv, it's been very awesome to talk with you. I thank you so much for giving us some time and contributing to this growing collaboration and collection of perspectives. And I hope we can have you on again sometime. It's been good getting to know you.
Yeah, today. Thank you so much. It's been really fun.
Alright, everybody, welcome back, and thanks so much for sticking around. Thanks to Dr. Rebecca Olive for taking the time to talk with me and all of us today. And please, please, please make sure you check out our website, movingoceans.com, where you can find all of her latest articles with such amazing titles. Listen to these, like, how about this one? Coastal Communities, Leisure, and Well-Being. Or maybe, are you interested in something more about why going for a swim in the ocean can be good for you and for nature? Or my first Rebecca Olive title, Living with Sharks. All good stuff and more. So check out movingoceans.com. With that being said, I just want to say that, you know, this conversation was very wide and we covered a lot of ground, but I think it's safe to say that the world of leisure and sport has a lot more going on below the surface than meets the eye. While some of us may think that leisure is just an escape from the day or for the daily stresses of life, I think once you go below the surface of many cultures surrounding our activities, it becomes obvious that many of the same intersections of gender, politics, environment, and much more social and cultural and ecological issues seem to intersect and exist right there in the world of leisure. Leisure time is a privilege that brings increased well-being through opportunities like exploration of one's interests, experimenting with bodily movements, and the opportunity to reflect on all of these things. With this privilege, I think, also comes a shred of responsibility to find ways to widen access towards others who have been marginalized or otherwise may not have it. As we discussed today, there are many perspectives in which to approach this issue, and I would love to hear if you have any you'd like to share. So please feel free to rate us here at the Transnatural Perspective Show. Hit up transnaturalperspectives.com and send me a message, or hit us up on Twitter, Facebook, or wherever you get your social media on. That's it, everybody. These are our Transnatural Perspectives for today. If you find value in this show, please consider becoming a monthly supporter. Please share this wherever you can. And hey, write us a review. You know, this is what keeps the show going. Thanks for listening, everybody. Until next time, get outside and get some perspective. Greetings, everyone. This is your host, Josh, here. Happy to say that the Transnatural Perspectives podcast is brought to us by listeners like you. If you find value in this show and you want to help it grow, please consider sharing this podcast, writing a review, and supporting the show. Head on over to transnaturalperspectives.com to learn more about how you can contribute as a monthly subscriber, as a one-time donor, as well as check out our blog. I invite you to contact me with any ideas you have for the show. If you'd like to be a guest, if you need a writer, or any other tips on further funding opportunities. I'd really love to hear from you. It keeps this show going, keeps me going. And with that being said, thanks for listening.